opinions and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We are at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at KFARradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Pruse. My format on Wednesdays is pioneers, historical Fairbanksons, interesting Fairbanksons, nefarious characters, and it's been a while since I've been on with Nick Nugent, and it's our third year now, sir.
It is.
It's been a great 3 years. And boy, what the history you bring on Alaska, or the local issues or items that have been built, so welcome, so encouraged, and look forward to that one Wednesday a month where you're in here and you're educating me on Alaska.
Well, it's been very enjoyable for me also because it gives me something to do being retired now. I am amazed sometimes I'll start researching or looking at one thing and I'll run into something else and 3 or 4 days are gone looking at that subject and then coming back.
You know, if I was in academia, I'd be a historian, you know, history teacher, because what you learn from history is so rich and so in depth. And then, like you said, when you start looking at one thing, the little trail that takes you off somewhere else and what you learn.
And I think it's interesting to see how some people's personalities and foibles either added to what they did or, in some instances, subtracted from what they were able to do.
Well, you have an interesting person today, Mr. Robert Steed Dunn. Now, most people don't know that person.
No, they wouldn't. Not much of a reason to.
Yeah.
Unless you're, maybe if you'd read the book, The Early Ascents of Mount McKinley, you would have picked up on his name.
Yeah, but before he even tried that, he was all over the world.
He was. He was born in 1877 in Newport, Rhode Island, and his family was an old established one. They were kind of the patricians of the area. A clue to that can be found in the fact that Dunn's father asked that they be removed from the social register when upstarts like the Vanderbilts were added.
Didn't want to be included with the lower class.
No, no, you know, that guy's only has millions, but no reputation.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Dunn grew up enjoying camping trips into New Hampshire, so he, as a young man, really spent a lot of time camping, packing, and trekking around, which he enjoyed quite a bit. Seems like he was in very good physical shape, you know, from a life of activity. He went to Harvard, graduated in 1898, cum laude, and he took off for the Klondike on the Edmonton route. I don't know if you know much about the Edmonton route.
That was a tough one.
It was the worst way to go. Yeah. 1 out of 5 died.
Yeah.
And it was just a miserable route. He later went to work for the New York Commercial Advertiser, editor of which was Lincoln Steffens, who was one of the most active muckrakers of that era, when there were certainly a lot of muckrakers.
The fake news boys.
That, or worse.
Yeah.
Steffens said of Dunn, Dunn could write, Dunn could bite. He bit and rode his way through with us for months. Well, in 1900, Dunn set out to take a trip along the Copper River. I don't know that he had a particular goal in mind, just some exploration. Get out, see what was up the river. Trying to follow up a little bit on Allen and some of the military expeditions. So not a lot was known about the area, but at least how to get through into the interior was known. So he followed those routes. He was the first man to discover that Mount Wrangell is actually a volcano.
Okay.
And he was went on up then to the Yukon, up the route through Mentasta Pass over to the Yukon, and mm-hmm. ended up in the 40-mile country, and just kind of explored and looked around at the mines there, and then came back. He spent most of his time on this trip with solo, except for a companion, a very large husky freight dog that he had bought from a native. He and the dog separated on the trip. When he got to Dawson, another miner comes walking along with the dog, and the dog instantly breaks away, comes over and starts, you know, yeah. nuzzling. And the other miner goes, oh, he's obviously your dog. You can have him back. Well, then in 1902, he was one of the first journalists to reach Martinique in the Caribbean mm-hmm. after the eruption of Mount Pelee. And I don't know if you know much about that, but it was a Nouée Ardente, which killed everybody in one of the cities, except for a poor fellow who was stuck in the dungeon. He was kind of a political prisoner, and he was thrown so far down in the dungeon that he was safe during all of it.
He's the sole survivor.
He was. The following year, 1903, Steffens made some contacts to allow Dunn to join the party of Dr. Frederick Cook on this expedition to climb Mount McKinley. Cook was a failed medical doctor. We may cover Cook at some time in the future. There's a lot to tell about him.
Okay.
Little of it good.
Our type of guy.
He was a fraudster. He lied about being the first man to summit Mount McKinley, not on this expedition, yeah. but on a later one, which led to the Pioneer Climb, which is something we can look at. Then he also lied about beating Admiral Byrd to the North Pole. And later, he served 5 years for fraud, eventually.
You know, I was just looking at that and saying to myself, what, you know, he didn't also go after Perry in the South Pole? Yeah. Oh, boy.
Well, there he would have had to be going up against
Amundsen.
Yeah, Amundsen, and that would have been a little bit harder. Those names were well-known enough that it'd be kind of hard to say that you beat them.
Yeah.
Well, Dunn's book, then, was published in 1907. The book didn't whitewash any of the hardships or details or lack of personality or bad personalities. He brought it all out. Interestingly, he never refers to Cook by name. He only calls him the professor, and that in a rather derisive fashion. During the expedition, though, Dunn was credited with discovering and naming Mount Hunter in the Alaska Range. The year before, 1906, Dunn had climbed the new volcanic island of Perry in the Bering Sea, discovered a series of craters at Mount Akmuk in the Aleutians. 1908, he led the first ascent of Mount Wrangell.
You know, he's one of those people that he went out on the journey of life and became an explorer.
Yes, he did. He wrote a semi-autobiographical book called The Youngest World in 1914. Well, that wasn't all he did.
Yeah.
And he became a war correspondent and became friends with Jack London in 1904. And they covered the Russo-Japanese War. They were again united while covering the landing of U.S. troops in Veracruz. When the First World War broke out, he left for Europe to cover it on behalf of the New York Evening Post. 1915, wrote about his experience in a book called Five Fronts. In 1916, he was back in the States with General Pershing chasing Pancho Villa through the northern Mexican desert.
Wow.
In one article there, he begins to show a little bit of the harshness of his personality when he describes in very minute detail the details of how to waterboard one of the Mexican revolutionaries.
I was reading that. I wonder if the CIA took lessons from him.
Well, you never know, but he was certainly there.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
1919 to 1922 saw him assigned to the United States High Commission in Constantinople. When the U.S. passed draft age, but he still joined the Navy and served on a destroyer hunting U-boats in the Atlantic.
You know, how did he afford this lifestyle?
Well, his family was very rich.
Yeah.
So he certainly wasn't, I don't think, doing it off journalist wages.
No, exactly.
And he was using personal money for a lot of it. And, of course, during the time he was in the military, someone would have been paying for him. When he got to Constantinople, one of the comments that was made was, he was a very intriguing force in local politics. You can kind of picture somebody like Sidney Greenstreet running around.
Fairbanks, with that, we are going to take a commercial break. We will be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com. Don't miss Fairbanks Foodies every Saturday at 5:30 on KFAR Radio with your host, David Pruse, discussing everything food in Fairbanks, from awesome recipes to all of your favorite local restaurants. Brought to you by Bobby's Downtown, Quality Food Sales, Hoodoo Brewery, and the Fairbanks Community Food Bank. Don't miss Fairbanks Foodies and go to the archives page of KFARradio.com to listen to any past episodes. Fairbanks Foodies, Saturdays at 5:30 on KFAR Radio and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Freeze your fat away without surgery or downtime with Cool Sculpting, an FDA-approved non-surgical cool way to treat muffin top, belly fat, bra, leg, and chin fat. The only Cool Sculpting in Interior Alaska is Solstice Medicine and Wellness. From your chin to your legs, don't just fight the fat, freeze it. Cool Sculpting makes fitting into your favorite fashions an attainable goal. You owe it to yourself to look your best. Call for your free consultation. Call Solstice Medicine and Wellness, 907-456-6334. 907-456-6334.
Fall is winter's two-minute warning. Prepare now. Secure dependable Honda power whenever and wherever you need it. Buy your Honda generator from the Woodway. Back up your home's boiler and fridge. Take it with you to camp, hunting, your remote work site, and on board your RV. Dependable, quiet, and easy to operate. Your whisper quiet Honda generator does more than just keep your lights turned on. It's waiting for you today at the Woodway on College Road. Prepare the Alaskan way, the right way, the Woodway.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Find Bridgestone and Cooper tires for every car, truck, motorhome, and SUV you drive. Everything you tow. GCR Tires and Service. The Tire Guys. Taming the Alaskan Road. Van Horn at Cushman.
KFAR. Weather.
Sunshine mixed with clouds at times. Today, with highs around 33. Winds out of the east, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Lows dip down to about 22. Tonight, cloudy skies. Overcast skies again. Tomorrow, highs level off around 30. Mid-30s, Friday and Saturday. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. David Pruse in the studio here with Nick Nugent, and we're talking about Robert Steed Dunn, a very unique, nefarious character of Alaska and other locations.
He was certainly a person who didn't mind speaking his mind.
No.
And Dunn volunteered during the Second World War. He's getting up to fair age at this point to be a naval attaché in Turkey. It's interesting because naval attaché in those
days. He's in his mid-60s.
Yes. Yeah. The Navy at that time had sort of a strategic intelligence outlook.
I was
going to
say, naval attaché, that's an intelligence officer.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's what we would call it today. He eventually returned home, wrote a novel called Horizon Fever about a war correspondent, a subject he knew well. He did a volume of poetry in 1945, and it's called Unleashed Love. Well, he died December 24th, 1955, after a long illness. His actual autobiography, World Alive, was published in 1956. The New York Times Book Review said this, "A wide-ranging and freewheeling odyssey, the story of a man of independent and often unorthodox opinions, a man bent on adventure and ready to face the dangers and hardships that adventure brings." So I think that sums him up pretty well. Well, let's now get back to where we were, the 1903 expedition to Mount McKinley. The story's one of failure. If they did not make the summit, they didn't do particularly well on any part of what they were doing, if you measure it only by its stated goals versus results. there weren't stories of great camaraderie on the trail. When I've gone through Allen's journals and even Kastner and some of the other people, they were, you know, we were wading chin deep in glacial streams. Today, an 8 spawned out salmon, but everybody was pulling together. Almost every page, Dunn is describing how someone was a slacker or a hothead, and he doesn't really, apparently no camaraderie ever developed, which a lot of times will happen during hardships. You pull together or you die together.
Yeah.
That never seems to have happened in this group. Probably they didn't spend enough time up front choosing the members and seeing who had an interest in what. Well, they didn't set out till June, whereas normally climbing attempts on Mount McKinley are over by June. Mm-hmm. That's the end of the season. So they were late before they even hit Alaska. If you look at what was going on, there were several attempts on different peaks. Mount St. Elias took 5 expeditions before the summit was reached. The summit expedition spent around $50,000, that in the early 1900s. A group of Italians came and climbed. In this first decade of the 1900s, there were as many as 11 attempts on Mount McKinley before the party with Bishop Stuck, Harry Karstens, and Walter...
Harper?
Harper, yes, thank you. That name just kind of went for a second. Well, many warned Dunn not to go to Alaska, but Brooks, who had been there the year before and had followed some of the same country, was optimistic that it was possible. He said they had a fighting chance of making it. Okay, if that's optimism, I'd hate to see a pessimist.
What got me about this expedition is that this started late.
On very, very late.
On everything, from the planning, anyway.
Well, Cook then was the leader in name, as well as being the topographer and meteorologist. Turns out he didn't know how to operate any tool except a barometer and a thermometer, and a thermometer pretty much operates itself.
Self, yeah.
So Dunn had once read, he said he had once read a geology book. He'd actually taken a geology class at Harvard. So he signed on as the publicist and geologist of the crew, if you will, with one semester's worth of knowledge. He also describes a fellow that he only calls Simon. He was the son of a wealthy family in New York City. He was added as a botanist, a task that he was unsuited for either by education or common sense. I wonder how did Cook think it was a good idea to bring someone. He was a New York City dweller, basically. Mm-hmm. And in Seattle, they hired an office worker who knew how to use a camera to be the expedition photographer. So again, somebody who's not necessarily a wilderness hand. And finally, two other members, a fellow named Fred King, who was a horse wrangler. He had actually been with Brooks the year before. So the only one out of 6 that really had any idea about this part of Alaska was the horse wrangler. Dunn, of course, knew some of the interior from his time over in the Copper River country.
Yeah.
So he had a bit of an idea. The final member was Jack. Jack was a foul-tempered Irishman who Dunn came to enjoy for the verbal abuse he piled on others. He wasn't much inclined to like him at first because, of course, Dunn's from this, you know, Anglo-Saxon family, and here's an Irishman with us.
Yeah.
And he wasn't sure he was going to like
vinegar
that.
And oil.
But he certainly came to enjoy him, as we would read later on. Dunn wanted to hire an alpinist and went to Banff to actually see if he could hire a Swiss guide. Well, none were available, but the horse packers told him, he said, the Swiss may be handy up on the rock and ice, but they'll wander till they die in the woods.
So, oh, my goodness.
It was just tough to find the crew they needed. So they set out with too little information, too little experience, and too little time. They had 15 cayuse horses, which they had bought in eastern Washington, none of which were broken to be packers. King, the horse packer, made the comment that these weren't the horses I would have bought. And that's kind of all he said about it. They planned 86 pounds of food per man per month that, along with their gear and horse tackle, made a load of 2,000 pounds spread out among 15 horses. They kept all the load on the horses, and they themselves walked because they didn't want to overburden the horses too much. They took only for flour, dried beans, and other staples, knowing that these were dependable. From their experience reading about people going to the Klondike, Dunn states, they shied away from any item described as patent, folding, or automatic. Well, the party set out from Seattle on the SS Santa Ana on June 10th, 1903, with five men. They hadn't yet picked up Jack. They picked him up in Valdez. When they arrived there, Jack was prospecting and was lured by King's tale of Brooks finding 12.5 cents per pan in the Susitna drainage. That was a fortune. You could live very happy on 12.5 cent pans.
Yes, you could.
And so he thought, yeah, I'll come along. And on arriving at Tyonek, he just kind of looked at Dunn and said, I believe I've been shanghaied. Well, they arrived at Tyonek around 3 a.m., went through an ordeal unloading the horses. You can imagine you're putting them in Cook Inlet, which is incredibly cold. They would only come so far in with a boat because they didn't want to get stuck on the mud flats, which was a good choice.
Yeah.
And so they swam the horses to shore and nearly lost a couple. On getting to shore, they lost their first horse. One ran away, never to be seen again, although they were able to round up 14 of them. Tyonek was chosen because that's where Brooks had originated his trip into the interior from. They planned to follow that route and the one used by Lieutenant Heron. In 1901, the mountain was known, of course, to a lot of native groups, but the Russians then called it Bolshaya in that area. A prospector named Dickey had named it from his view on the Susitna Valley. In 1899, Heron approached, and it and Mount Foraker from the west. It was finally, though, Brooks who came to the base in 1902. Dunn mentions having seen it from the Ketchum Stuck Hills. So clear up just above Eagle, you could see, you know, with the clear weather then, you could see it, and also from the slopes of Mount Wrangell. As they had been climbing on
it's a big hill.
Yes, it is. Now, get a little bit of elevation, though, so you're seeing over the horizon and it comes up quickly. Well, from Tyonek, it was only 150 miles or so distant to the base. But following the tributaries to the Susitna and the route that Heron and Brooks had used ended up making them swing west, and partly due to conditions, some poor navigation, and following Brooks's route, they actually took a trip of 450 miles. So they've got a late start, and now they're walking 450 miles, which is just making them later and later.
Yeah.
Falling in. On the 24th of June, that was the first day of packing, Cook began to show his lack of worth by staying concerned with the survey instruments that he didn't even know how to use while everybody else packed the horses. King and Jack were basically mad at Cook on the first day, and that stayed.
So they're there on the 24th of June, and that's usually after the season is closing.
Oh, that's
closing.
A good month. Yeah. I remember going to Talkeetna, and they mentioned one time usually the season's over by Memorial Day.
Yeah.
Well, Jack offered to quit and then decided to go ahead and stay with him. The thought of the gold pulled him in.
Fairbanks, we are going to take a commercial break here. You're listening to KFAR Radio, where you're at 458-TALK, 907-458-8255. I'm going to leave you with some Eric Clapton bumper music. I approve this music. Then we're going to go into some Fox News, some state news, some commercials, some weather. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
President Biden today again condemning Russia's attacks on civilian targets in Ukraine.
Brutal. It's beyond the pale.
Russia has stepped up its attacks since a weekend explosion of a key bridge linking Russia to Russian-occupied Crimea. The FDA is recommending the CDC give final approval for children between 5 and 11 to be eligible for the reformulated COVID-19 booster shots.
The American Academy of Pediatrics says just 38% of kids ages 5 to 11 have received one original COVID vaccine dose, and just 31% of kids have received two doses.
Fox's Jessica Rosenthal. A judge today ruling former President Trump must sit for a deposition next week in a defamation lawsuit filed by a writer who says he raped her in the 1990s. Trump has denied her claims. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
Alaska Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy leads his challengers in fundraising for the latest reporting period ahead of the November 8th general election. His campaign reported in a filing with the Alaska Public Offices Commission about $600,000 in contributions between August 7th and Friday, with nearly $920,000 available at the end of the reporting period. Democrat Les Garza's campaign reported about $400,000 in contributions, with nearly $520,000 available. Independent Bill Walker's campaign reported nearly $460,000 in contributions, with about $470,000 available. Dunleavy critics have cited concerns about a lack of paid staff working on his campaign. The Alaska Public Offices Commission on Wednesday is set to consider whether to expedite a hearing on a complaint by a public advocacy group that allege, in part, that the governor appears to be subsidizing his campaign both with official staff's activities as well as activities by the recipients of no-bid contracts with the governor's office. Dunleavy's campaign has called the complaint a frivolous and unfounded political attack masquerading as a serious complaint.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
Alaska has a champion standing up for our military and veterans, Senator Lisa Murkowski. Lisa secured billions for our military bases and defense jobs and worked tirelessly to deliver a pay raise for our troops. And Lisa's fighting to ensure that our veterans have access to the care and benefits they earned. Investing in our Alaska-based military, taking care of our veterans. Lisa Murkowski.
Alaska's veterans serve with honor. They deserve our support and respect. As your senator, I'm working across party lines to make sure every veteran gets the care they earned, improving the VA so Alaska's veterans can receive quality care here at home instead of traveling to the lower 48, and securing funding to expand mental health services and help prevent suicides. I'm for Alaska, always.
Lisa Murkowski, a champion for Alaska's military and veterans.
I'm Lisa Murkowski. I'm running for the U.S. Senate, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Lisa Murkowski for U.S. Senate.
Winter is here, and maybe you're already feeling it, that closed-in feeling. That means it's time for a road trip to Anchorage, and the Diamond Center Hotel is ready to make your stay complete. First, there's their central location, just a short distance from skiing, sightseeing, shopping, and dining. And after a long day, their large rooms offer all the amenities, including their custom-made ultimate dream beds, plus the luxury of their deep-soaking jetted tubs, big enough for two. So get ahead of that cabin fever and come see what Anchorage has to offer at the Diamond Center Hotel. Book your room today online at DiamondCenterHotel.com or give them a call at 770-5000.
Your snow shovel get buried in the last blizzard? Century Hardware has the wintertime tools you need right now. You need ice chippers? Century has ice chippers. You need lock de-icer? They have lock de-icer. Snow rakes? Arctic grade extension cords? Yep. And of course, snow shovels. Lots of them. Weekend warriors of winter don't just fight the snow and ice. Conquer it with some help from Century Hardware. Get your gear in here. Ralph does, so should you. Century Hardware, what you need right now.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. David Perruz in the studio here with Nick Nugent. We are discussing the unique person. I can't call him an Alaskan. He spent a lot of time here. But Robert Steed Dunn, he covered a lot of Alaska.
Yes, he did, and certainly was involved in some very early alpine ascents, or attempts at least.
Attempts, we'll call it.
Well, the photographer Miller took off with a boat from Tyonek and went up the Susitna. And his eventual, took Simon with him, and they had found out from talking to people around Tyonek, they could eventually reach the Beluga River, meet up with the horse train, and that would keep the big boxed scientific instruments, which pack very poorly, in the boat. And the other items that were in sacks and bags, the foodstuffs, could go with the horses. Well, the horses made terrible progress as they take off because they had no training. The conditions on the tundra were terrible. The horses were falling down constantly. Every once in a while, the mosquito hordes would drive them to the point where they'd just go bucking across the country, throwing supplies everywhere. Or maybe worse yet, when you've got food supplies, they'd jump into ponds like a moose does and stand there with only their head sticking out, soaking everything. They had a terrible time getting the horses up and out of the water until Kink came up with the idea of pouring water up their nostrils. So apparently they waterboarded horses too. And the abuse of the abuse of their pack animals that you read about in the diary would make us flinch today. Yep. You can't very well like anybody just for the way they treated everything around them. Well,
boy,
Jack lost his pipe. And Dunn notes that it's amazing the new oaths that an Irishman can come up with when aggravated. So you can see these little prejudices. Also, and it shows up a lot, Dunn was anti-Semitic. He did not want Simon even on the trip. That was not an uncommon attitude amongst people with his background.
The blue bloods of New England. Yeah.
And he makes a comment that he was not against Jewish people for their religion, but for their racial characteristics, which I think it makes, to me, that's a little bit more onerous than saying you don't like someone's religion.
Yeah.
And so that was done again. Patrician, I'm a little bit better than everybody else here, and I know it. Well, they arrived then at the Beluga, and the professor abandoned the pack train to Dunn and took off on the boat. They had found out more information, and they could make another leap with the boat and move supplies back and forth. So the 27th, 28th, they were only able to, this still being June, they were only able to make 8 miles progress because basically of the horses jumping into the ponds so much. It took a terrible amount of time to get them back out. One would do it, they'd all do it. On the 1st of July, they finally reached the Tordello foothills. And the winter trail was lost. Here Dunn tells us and explains in his diary that King was a little bit slow of mind, the horse packer. He'd been on this route, remember, the year before. And he said he was slow of mind by about a day. He would usually remember an important landmark and a turn in the trail the day after we passed it.
Oh, my goodness.
So they were just navigation problems again. Everything that could go wrong was. And he said they found out quickly the shortest trail was seldom ever the best choice.
That is correct.
Sticking with the hilltops and ridges as much as possible was the way to go. Well, they had some other unpleasant discoveries. The professor had taken all their good sleeping bags and tents and also had left
them. This is Mr. Cook.
Yes, and had left them with only 12 matches. And Simon decided that they needed some meat. So he went off to hunt some grouse that he saw, took 20 shots at the grouse, didn't hit a single grouse, but shot one of the horses in the jaw.
Oh, my goodness.
And King allowed us to how perhaps we should not allow him to shoot near the camp. Well, a short time later, they reached the 12.5-cent creek. The mosquitoes were horrible. Gold wasn't found. And Jack threw away all of their prospecting equipment in kind of a rage and frustration. Large bear ambled past. They were interested in the meat from the bear to supplement their rations. So they pulled out their gun, which was, they thought, a 300 Savage. They had dropped the rifle off to have peep sights installed in Seattle, and the gunsmith gave them back a different Savage rifle that was 30-30 Winchester, so none of their cartridges would chamber.
You ready for a phone call?
I am.
This is getting from sad to worse. Good morning. You're on KFAR Radio, and your name is?
Hey, it's Charles.
Hey, Charles. How you doing?
Glenn Allen was named after a guy, Glenn. He was in charge of both Heron and Castner expeditions, but he actually was charged with torture or something like that. Yep. Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. They finally got to Squintna on July 5th. Here, the willows and alders were just incredibly dense, so they had to chop trail. The horses would brush the packs off, tear holes in the bag. So now their food supply is starting to dwindle just by loss rather than consumption. They looked and looked for the ford, and Dunn spoke to Jack about not finding an Eldorado. And Jack, at this point, just turned around and looked at him and said, "Why, I've been a prospector long enough to know most of those stories aren't true," and just kind of took it at that, which I guess shows the prospector's mentality. The next big strike's right over the hill.
Oh, my goodness.
On the 8th, they reached a stream that they called the Talashalitna, and the professor, Miller, and two natives were there. Miller tells Jack that the whole time coming up the river, the professor sat in the back of the boat steering with an oar while Miller did all of the poling, jumping out in shallow water and dragging the boat through with a rope. And the professor's excuse was he needed to be there to keep the instruments safe.
Oh, my goodness.
So now Jack doesn't like the professor as much as Dunn doesn't. They ascended Mount Yenlo to scope out the country on July 13th. The 18th, they had had 7 days of rain. No place they went was less than ankle-deep water. So they're never dry. Nothing's ever dry. On July 22nd, they finally made 10 miles when they came to a stream that they could follow the gravel bars for quite a way.
Yeah.
Because of the way it was trending. Jack took very ill on the 24th of July with chest pains, which was originally diagnosed as neuralgia. King confided that, well, Jack's actually been sick several days now. On the 25th, Dunn caught Simon holding on to the horses so they would drag him across to ford, and the horses were barely able to get across themselves. So he gave Simon a beating for shirking his work and resolved to do it again as needed.
Don't make me do this again, I will.
Exactly. They were looking for Simpson Pass, used by Heron, as King couldn't remember which pass Brooks had went through.
Oh, my goodness.
They weren't a day past it yet.
Yeah.
And the maps here were maddeningly devoid of detail. Jack continued to get worse. Miller and Dunn searched for the pass, while the professor and King searched another valley. Finally, Dunn went out of camp in the evening just to get away from people. Walked along and some clouds moved and the mist cleared, and he actually saw the entry to the pass. So they were back on track at that point. July 30th, Jack was played out. He was done. And they left him, and the professor gave him their worst horse, telling Jack, well, follow when you're able. And Jack got a certain amount of revenge on them. When slightly recovered, he set out for Tyonek, went directly back to their boat with the cache supplies, and took the boat down the river to Tyonek, leaving the rest of the party with a miserable few extra days of rafting because they didn't have their boat. This type of thing went on. There was no cohesion in the group. Yeah. Simon was apparently...
internal conflict the whole time.
Yeah, and Cook did nothing. Simon was apparently the least liked because he was a shirker.
And they were going to climb Mount Denali. This was their goal.
Yes.
And now it's almost August 1.
Uh-huh. Getting right there. Yeah. Well,
you're 2 months late on the coming outside.
Jack, as a going-away present, because he also hated Simon, carefully burned holes in all of his mosquito netting that couldn't be repaired. And apparently Simon took a patent medicine that drew even more mosquitoes to him than perhaps some of the others did. And so Jack thought that would be an enjoyable thing to do. Later, when Simon was shirking and they were up on the glaciers where everything's icy and wet, they burned his caribou hides so that he had nothing to sleep on. So it's surprising that he made it through the trip or that they didn't just fall out and all kill each other somewhere out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
That's what I find more amazing is how much they would aggravate each other and nobody just picked up a club and hit anybody while they were asleep.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Changeover season is just around the bend, and what better way to celebrate than by cruising into Alyeska Tire for a new set of Nokian winter tires. We're proud to carry some of the most popular premium tires on the market. Models like Nokian's Hakkapeliitta R4, the Hakkapeliitta 10, even the Hakkapeliitta 10 EV. We see you, EV drivers. Alyeska Tire, we're always with you.
Don't miss Fairbanks Foodies every Saturday at 5:30 on KFAR Radio with your host, David Pruse, discussing everything food in Fairbanks, from awesome recipes to all of your favorite local restaurants. Brought to you by Bobby's Downtown, Quality Food Sales, Hoodoo Brewery, and the Fairbanks Community Food Bank. Don't miss Fairbanks Foodies and go to the archives page of KFARradio.com to listen to any past episodes. Fairbanks Foodies, Saturdays at 5:30 on KFAR Radio and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
At Glass Doctor, our trained specialists are experts at fixing foggy and cracked glass, leaving any residential window looking like new without replacing the entire window. Bring back the view of any window with Glass Doctor. Visit glassdoctor.com to request a free estimate on repairing your foggy or cracked windows. Let Glass Doctor bring back your view.
Call the Glass Doctor, we'll fix your paint. Oh, yeah!
Attend the Find Out Free Pregnancy Center's Fall Fundraising Banquet. Learn what's new at the clinic and how you can help them continue their life-changing mission, assisting and empowering women, men, and families through their journeys from pregnancy to parenting. Plan to attend the Find Out Free Pregnancy Center's Fall Fundraising Banquet, Friday, October 14th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Lighthouse Church. For more information and to sign up today, visit findoutfree.com. That's F-Y-N-D, findoutfree.com.
KFAR weather.
A blend of clouds and sun today with highs around 33. Easterly winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Overcast tonight, lows level off around 22. Cloudy skies expected tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 30. Mainly sunny skies and calm. Friday, clouds on the increase by Saturday. Highs in the mid-30s. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. David Pruse in studio here with Nick Nugent. We're talking about Robert Steed Dunn and his exploits in life and his exploits in Alaska. And he was basically from east to west,
absolutely,
north to south. He hit it all that he could.
The idea of a man addicted to adventure, I think, does actually fit him pretty well.
It does.
So August 2nd, they crossed the range by the pass that Dunn had finally found. They reached Brooks Camp on August 14th. Now they've got a really good look at the mountain, and they're beginning to think, this isn't good. They're, you know, having a terrible time slogging through snow.
Yeah, you're starting to get the, your elevations are up.
And it is snowing at night sometimes. Fresh water was hard to find. As I mentioned during the break, they ended up making tea one day by water they wrung out of the horse blankets. So,
not even their own, just the horse blankets. Yeah.
And, you know, the word hardship hardly applies. It just doesn't seem like a strong enough word.
You know, the trip of misery.
Exactly. Well, they made preparations for the ascent. They started baking hardtack, getting things broke down into smaller packs, and they allowed 10 days ration for the climb, and the professor decided they could all go. He was at one time wanted someone to stay with the camp and the horses, but realized the horses weren't going to get that far away. There was grass where they were, and it wasn't great, but they would survive. Then on the 19th, in very heavy rain, they started out searching a route they could use. They were on a glacier, which is very likely the Peters Glacier, named by Brooks the year before. The route turned steep quickly, was terrible on the horses with them breaking through the snow crust. The professor's barometer said showed they were at about 7,500 feet. So they're not even hardly a third of the way to the summit. You consider the base is at 2,200 feet. They haven't made much progress. The next morning dawned very clear, gave them a spectacular view, and Miller was sent back with the horses to keep camp. So now there's four of them. Indecision by Cook caused them to camp in a very exposed position and ride out a terrible storm. He couldn't make up his mind. The storm hit. They couldn't move. They were stuck. Cook decided with Simon that perhaps they should go to Mount Foraker and see if there was a better route. So now they're backtracking. The 25th of August. So now we're in the end of August. It's winterish weather at that elevation will start showing up. They wandered to numerous dead ends. They discovered a cache of salt, though, which was a matter of rejoicing. Their salt had been gone for weeks from getting wet. They also found some film wrappers and discarded clothing and thought it might be Brooks, but it was likely one of the other early parties that had come up through the area. Remember, there were a number of early ascent attempts. Simon went back to base camp and got lost and wasn't able to rejoin the party till someone came and got him. On the 26th, they thought they found a ridge that would lead to the summit and that they could get there in 5 days. They also were starting to look for ways to retreat to the Susitna. They knew that, boy, once we're done, we better get out of here. Well, the combination of poor diet and cold made them listless, and elevation likely. The professor and Dunn scouted the trail, were never joined by their companions. They found them all back at camp asleep. They're, again, likely altitude issues. They were at 11,300 feet at this time, still far short of the summit. On the 31st of August, they reached a point where they realized they couldn't make the summit by this route. And that route actually was climbed in 1954. But by people with a totally different amount of experience, equipment, and who did not hike all the way in from Tyonek.
Yeah, they were more buffed.
They found they had only one sack of flour and one of beans, but they also found out on the north side the animals weren't very skitterish. The professor had an old 44 rimfire rifle, and they were able to get so close to caribou they could shoot them and began to have a little bit of caribou added to their diet. They killed a moose, which gave them five sacks of meat. They went to the Muldrow Glacier and descended 3,000 feet. The day was clear. They could actually see Lake Minchumina from there. They were headed into totally unmapped areas, but they still believed the Susitna came north of the range. They also knew that the Cantwell River, which we call the Nananada Day, went far south, and they were hoping that would be an easy way from where they were to the other river. Rudimentary explorations existed, and they realized then that the Cantwell was the best way to head to. That had been the route taken by Sergeant Yannert in 1898, when he was with all of those military explorations of 98. They traveled, and Simon, in a rare bit of comprehension, seeing some of the ridges and glaciers, actually pointed out a number of ridges that would probably eventually be used to summit the mountain. And Dunn said it's perhaps the only thing he understood in 3 months. Well, Dunn here relates a little bit about Simon, who he's apologized to. He's finally realized, okay, we're going to get out of here. And he tells us about Simon, and he says Simon's father produced paint. And he said, from listening to Simon tell me about it, it can be used to roof the desert, mend holes in your head, heart, or cabin. It's bulletproof, acid-proof, waterproof, fireproof, God and devil-proof. And in every uncivilized part of the world, pioneers bless it nightly with flesh sacrifices. Oh, so you can see the level of sarcasm that he used often. Well, they eventually were able to cross over by what I believe is called Andrew's Pass. They went from the Muldrow over. They decided that this pass looks low enough. Let's make a trek for it. We know the Chilitna's on the other side. So they made it through, and they eventually got to the Chilitna. They thought these canyons on the Chilitna would never end, terrible to go through with horses. They eventually got to enough water that they were able to start building rafts. And at that point, they were rafting down. Now, the first raft they made, they tried cottonwood. It soaked so full of water that it barely stayed afloat and probably weighed 3 tons. Mm-hmm. So they had to abandon it. They dropped the horses off. They just left them to fend for themselves. They had no room for them. They built 2 smaller rafts. And on the 16th, they set off abandoning the horses. Fred, the packer, and Dunn took 1 raft while the others used the second. The Rocky River beat the rafts up pretty bad. They had to relace them together every night. So it still wasn't, just because they were on the water, they weren't necessarily on an easy way to go. And of course, remember, Jack's happily back in Tyonek with the boat at this point. Well, they ran into a small group of prospectors who were headed downriver. They'd been as far as where the rafts had been built and were headed back. They realized where the party had been because they'd heard of them when they were at Tyonek. Well, Dunn's group was given tobacco, pipes, and fed. They were given the lay of the land and told they were only 25 miles from the Susitna and could probably not be more than 100 from the Susitna Station trading post. So at that point, they began to realize, okay, this is going to work. They got finally out of the canyons where the Susitna hits, or the Chulitna, I'm sorry, comes into the Susitna. And at that point, traveling wasn't easy, but at least wasn't as dangerous. They weren't in fear of being swamped at any minute. On the 24th, they hauled up to talk with a prospector who wanted to impress them with news of the world. They learned the Pope had died, Russia was ready to fight Japan, someone had killed the Queen of Serbia. It had mostly, though, according to him, been a quiet summer, and then he turned around and just wandered off after telling him everything he knew. Obviously, prospectors got a little light on their abilities when they were out by themselves too long. They obtained a boat here, though. There were other prospectors, and the trip to Tyonek then would be pretty straightforward. Dunn relates as to how Simon had a terrible sweet tooth. Dunn blames him for having eaten all their sugar on the trip. And he said he had such a sweet tooth that he was happy buying from the trading post candy, which was likely produced in the Silurian age. But this diary isn't one of the Edwardian age gilded stories. It's a gritty tale of a group pulled together with no consideration for skills or experience. There were almost daily feuds and broke out into fights. Most took out their frustrations on the horses. When you read about how they treated the horses, it just is beyond comprehension to us in our age. It failed from a lack of poor leadership, which all of Cook's adventures did. Mismatched members, and a lack of information about the land. They went into a lot of unknown areas. They had no idea where the route to the mountain might even be. They didn't create new maps because Cook didn't know how to operate the surveying equipment, and no one else did. So they added very, very little to the knowledge of the area, which would have been beneficial, but it didn't come from them. The only single accomplishment, other than not actually having a party member die, was the circumnavigation of Mount McKinley. So they went all the way from south to north, around and back. That feat was not repeated until 1978.
Wow.
So that was pretty much what they did.
Nick, thank you very much for that presentation. My goodness. You know, when you say they don't make them like that anymore, they just don't in many ways.
But doesn't it tell us a little bit about how even an office worker from Seattle, Miller, made the trip?
Yeah.
People walked more, and they were just, I think, mentally tougher in a lot of ways.
Fairbanks, that is our show. Nick, you have a great day. Thank you. And Fairbanks, I will see you on Friday.
Thank you.
News and conversation. KFAR 660 AM.